Okay, so again, we're in week 7 of our journey through the Sermon on the Mount, which we're calling Another Way. This is the recap portion. It takes up like half of the time, so just buckle in here. We've put this this picture up every week. Pastor Darren has talked about how we oftentimes find ourselves with our feet planted within this room. There's a window outside, but we view ourselves as people with our feet planted in this room. We see the Sermon on the Mount as a list of rules to follow with our feet planted firmly in the kingdom of earth. But Jesus is standing outside of that window, and the Sermon on the Mount is Jesus calling us outside, calling us to this impossible new way of living. It's a grace-empowered way of living that calls us further than anything we've experienced before. This quote is put up every single time, if I can get it up there. Gonna keep on hitting this button until something happens. All right. Oh, good. All happen at once. Okay. Oh, there it is. So, he puts this quote up every week and says, okay, now just take your time and just read this on your own, and you never actually have time to read it on your own before we move on to the next thing. So maybe, I don't know, you want to take a picture or something? I'm not going to give you time to read it. In this, though, I want to focus again on this first sentence, because as Jesus calls us out onto that window, out into this other way of living, we're not called alone. A lot of times, whenever we view the law, we view it as this list of things to follow when we're by ourselves. You know, I don't speed, I don't jaywalk. Okay, I don't speed, I don't jaywalk. I just need to follow this checklist and I'll be fine. But this other way, this grace-filled way of living is a way that we are called to walk together. We can't do it alone. We need God's grace in us, but also we need each other. We need to walk alongside each other. We're the body of Christ. We are Christ to one another. Whenever we offer somebody a shoulder to lean on, this is the shoulder of Christ. Whenever we speak God's word to each other, this is the voice of Christ. If we offer a hand, a guiding hand for another, this is the hand of Christ for that person. We together are Christ's body on earth. And so this is a path that we walk as the people of God, as the church. And we're called to more than that. I think I actually did just give you time to read that, if you weren't listening to me. So, we have this timeline. This timeline that shows the world as God created it, with this crown face up. Right side up world, God created it. Birds are singing Disney princess songs and everybody is happy. But then like 3 chapters in, sin enters the picture. The world is turned upside down and they're still talking snakes, I guess, but they no longer have legs, I guess they had. Anyway, so this is the world oftentimes as we see it, the world as we perceive it. It's this upside down, sin-filled world. But then Jesus comes into the picture and with teaching and with death and with resurrection begins to turn this crown right side up. And here we are in the interim, this purple space in between. We're living as people with a crown that sometimes seems to be tilted back upside down, and a crown that sometimes seems to be tilting back the right way, and we are called as the people of God to actively move, to turn this crown right side up in this upside down world, or at least to live as people who are right side up in an upside down world. It's this impossible thing that we're called to, but with the grace of Christ and with the church around us, we can live in this way. We then move on to this diagram. We talked about how Jesus has come to complete what the law was created for in the first place. And, you know, Pastor Darren loves super simple diagrams, so we have this explosion of arrows here. We have God and we have humanity turning away from God. And then the law comes in and humanity is reoriented. Humanity is turned back around to face towards God. But there's still this huge gap between us and God. And so God in Christ comes to meet us where we are, incarnate in the world as a human person. It comes to bring us back closer to God, to bring us to God, calls us out of that window and out onto this path that leads directly to God. And that's the path that we're called to in the Sermon on the Mount. And the 6 statements that follow, the 6 antitheses, again, for those of you participating in Jeopardy at some point in the future. The six statements that follow, they flow directly from Jesus' talk of completing the work of the law. Because Jesus completes the work of the law, we have this standard formula, these next six statements. You have heard what the law says, but I tell you, but I call you to this grace-filled way of living. I'm calling you, Jesus says, to live further than what the law could call you towards. I'm calling you to this impossible grace-filled life. And so the statements are just going to get harder. Last week, we looked at the first of these six statements. We looked at, you know, you've heard it said, don't murder, don't kill. But I say, don't even be angry. And they only get harder from there. So Jesus starts us off with murder, starts us off with anger, and then is going to, every single one of these six antitheses are going to get harder and harder and harder. By the end of it, we're supposed to love our enemies, whatever that means. Hopefully Pastor Darren knows. So Jesus called us not to even hold anger. Because holding anger is the road that leads us to murder. So Jesus saying, don't even hold anger, is Jesus saying, don't even set foot on the road that leads to murder. Remember, we're called not to be Batman. Batman is this character who draws this line in the sand. He's not going to murder. That's pretty much it. You know, he'll beat a guy to a pulp, and this bad guy will say, go ahead, Batman, finish me off. I know you want to. And Batman will respond, I don't murder. It's not my way. He thinks himself super pious for doing this. But we're called to be more than Batman's Batman. We're called not to just have this line in the sand. We're called not to even set foot on the path that leads us to that line. We don't hold anger. We're people of grace. Stated positively, we're people called to love. Stated not as a thou shalt not do this or that, but stated positively, love. This is the command that Jesus calls us to. This is the grace that Jesus calls us to, because the upside down world, that's a world that holds hatred. But the kingdom of heaven operates with love, with reconciliation and grace and mercy. The kingdom of heaven operates with forgiveness. And eventually, we're supposed to extend that forgiveness even to our enemies. That's a spoiler for those of you that haven't read yet, for those of you that haven't done your homework. We're called to live according to the kingdom of heaven, this right side up world, this crown facing upward. And today, we have the second one. I told you they're going to get harder and harder. Today, we have the second one. So if you want to turn in your Bibles to Matthew chapter 5, verses 27 through 30, you're welcome to. If you don't, if you just want to read on the screen, that's fine. If you want to close your eyes and listen to these words as Jesus' community would have heard them, albeit in English, then that's fine as well. So Matthew chapter 5, verses 27 through 30. You've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It is better for your whole body to be thrown into blah, blah. It's better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to go into hell. This is the word of the Lord. Right? Oh, man. So we follow the same formula, right? Jesus says, you've heard it said not to commit adultery. So where, again, where have they heard this said? Where have we heard this before? Yeah, this is another of the Big Ten, right? This is something that they all would have heard in their local synagogues. This is one of the Big Ten Commandments. Like, even if they haven't memorized the 490-some-odd laws that they have, they know this one. So, yeah, you've heard it said not to commit adultery. Because if we're going to live according to this kingdom, well, grace calls us to live more than just the law, but still to live out the law. So don't commit adultery, but we're called to further than that. We're called not to lust. So before we move forward, we need to talk a little bit about what lust is and what lust isn't. And I know it's a little strange. Pastor Darren thought it would be a good idea for a 26-year-old single man to come up here and talk to you guys about lust and adultery. So that's exciting. As I was preparing for this, I had the thought, is this how Catholic priests feel like all the time? It has to be, right? But here we are. This is where we're at. So let's talk a little bit about what lust is and what lust isn't. Because a lot of us think that lust is just this noticing something about someone, right? You see someone on the side of the street and you're like, oh, she's cute. Or, oh, he's cute. Handsome, whatever words we're using, I don't know. But this momentary emotion, this fleeting thought and that emotion tied to it, sometimes we look at that and we think that that is lust. We think that that's a part of lusting after someone. And I mean, I know that the grace of God is a great and wondrous thing, but we just were not created to not be able to do that, right? That's not lust. Lust is an action. Lust is the conquest of another person in your head. Lust is an activity of stripping somebody down, stripping the personhood of a person away so that they can fit a mold that you can then objectify, so that they can fit a mold that will satisfy your own desires. That's what lust is. And I'm going to use this metaphor again. You're going to have to get used to this gesture and me saying it's a stripping down, because I tried practicing without, and it's just going to come up a lot. So just like last week, we learned about how holding anger is the road that leads to murder. Jesus said, don't set foot on that road. Don't even anger. You guys aren't Batman. You know that. Jesus didn't say that, but I'm saying it. But this week, we're learning about lust. And lust is this road that leads to adultery. And this is Jesus saying, don't even step foot on that road. Regardless of whether you end up at the point of adultery, you're still stripping down this person. You're not even supposed to set foot on that road. I don't have a good Batman-esque example for lust. They're just, I only know so many superheroes, guys, I'm sorry. But we live in this culture, right? We live in a culture within a culture, sort of, that values purity, which is a good thing. It really is. But sometimes within that culture, single people will then say, okay, well, I just need to draw this line in the sand, just this not having sex line. I just need to draw this line in the sand. And provided I don't step over that line, I'm fine. Or married people come together and they say, well, provided I don't actually commit adultery, provided I don't actually act on this, you know, it's fine. You know, this sort of, I can look, but I can't touch kind of mentality. This is the culture that Jesus is speaking against. These are the lines in the sand that people tend to draw, that Jesus is calling us to more than. Last week, we talked about how holding anger is like saying to somebody, I wish you were dead. This week, we talk about how holding lust is like saying, I wish that you were mine. It's turning somebody into an object that you can control, even if it's only in your head. And just like how last week was about how we treat the other, this week is about how we treat the other. And so will all the weeks following. Both of these things, holding anger and lusting, they're about, they disregard, they diminish the sacredness of the image of God in another person. It is stripping down of the humanity, but also of the divine spark, this thing that makes that person a child of God. Lust takes a person who's made in the image of God, and it turns them into an object. It cheapens them. It objectifies them, and it turns them into a product for my personal use. We rationalize lust, though, right? Just like we do with anger, just like we even do sometimes with murder, with killing. We try and rationalize lust. We say, it doesn't hurt anyone. I mean, what's the harm in looking if I'm not touching, right? It's not actually harming anyone if it's only taking place in my head. This is clearly a serious matter to Jesus. We can see this from the way that he says that our salvation is in jeopardy. We can see this from the way he starts talking about amputating body parts. This is a serious issue for Jesus. And just for a second, I want us to take a step back and to talk about television and movies. And not just to say, you know, be careful about what you take in, which is an important thing to walk away from, but how relationships are portrayed in television and in movies, the way that we see adultery played out. Adultery is frequently a part of the plots in television and movies because we like conflict and we need drama. Without conflict, there is no story, and adultery is just great conflict. So what are some of the things, what are some of the rationalizations people have whenever they are trying to explain their adultery to their significant other, to their spouse? What are some of the things that they say when they're trying to explain this behavior? Anyone think of any? Oh, so sometimes we get blaming of the other person. Oh, sometimes they've done it first. I get, yeah. What about for them? Like whenever they're, even if they're trying to apologize. Ooh, it didn't mean anything. That's a good one. That's something that you hear a lot. It didn't mean anything. Oh, it just what? What's something that we? It just happened. That's a big one. I don't know why. It was an accident. Right? It's an accident. It just happened. And even if there were such a world that this could just be an accident, a happenstance, even if this were some sort of magical movie where even kissing doesn't seem to be governed by two consenting adults, but rather by the gravitational force of two people's lips. You've seen movies. Even if such a world were to exist, right? It's not just this one yes. It's not just this, I said yes this one time, and so now I'm in this situation. There were 1,000 lesser yeses that led to this point. And each yes was easier than the one before it. You know, we talk a lot about things being a slippery slope. It's actually a fallacy, right? Oh, this is a slippery slope to this. Well, there isn't really a slippery slope that leads to adultery. People don't just wake up one morning and suddenly, whoa, I think I'm going to cheat on my spouse today. It's not, right? It's not possible. They don't just wake up one morning and magically become adulterers. No, they're stairs. Each yes they give is a stair that leads down this path. Just like with anger, lust is a path that leads to adultery. Sorry, but it is. So Karim Roberts talks about lust in this way. He says that lust is not sexual attraction. It's a disordered understanding of one's self and others. Lust forgets the personhood and focuses only on self-gratification. Since lust is a powerful emotion, focused on one's desires and not on the well-being of the other, it has no place in the kingdom of God. We're not a community in which people are available to us for the taking. Such a community is tragic indeed, and only breeds distrust, jealousy, and heartache. In God's kingdom, people relate to each other as whole beings, not just as temporary fixes for untamed desires. Each yes that we give makes it that much easier to move towards objectifying other people. Each yes we give to lust makes it that much easier. And in our day, it's really hard to discuss lust without addressing pornography, right? We wish we could just go around it, but we can't. Pornographic images feed lust. seeing pornographic images, seeing pornographic videos, they make it that much easier to objectify people in the real world. You see these people on a screen and you turn them into an object, these real, actual people, and that's just one yes that leads to another. It makes it that much easier. It's almost like practice for objectifying people that you see in your day-to-day. Pornographic images feed lust. They cause lust to grow. They make lust easier. And there's this great myth in America that no one is being harmed. There's a myth that nobody is being harmed, but pornography is not victimless, even if we're not just talking about the selfhood of the person who is a victim. But pornography isn't even victimless in the traditional understanding. There's a direct connection between pornography and the sex slave industry in the United States. A lot of people maybe don't even realize that slavery is still a major issue, but human trafficking is a huge problem in the United States. And Nashville, just an hour and a half away from here, is one of the largest sites for sex trafficking in America. The sex slave industry is alive and well. It preys on children and runaway teenagers and the poor and the vulnerable. It uses violence and deceit and drugs in order to coerce these people into a life of sexual slavery. And there is a strong connection between pornography and the sex slave industry. There was a study done by Fight the New Drug that showed that they talked to almost 900 women who were within the sex service industry, a number of whom were a part of sexual human trafficking. Talked to almost 900 of these women, and 49% of them said that videos were taken of them, pictures were taken of them, that pornography was created of them while they were within this sex trade industry. 47% of these women said that that violence and coercion and drugs were used in order to force them into this industry. This is not a victimless crime. And pornography fuels the sex slave industry. It creates a demand for the sex slave industry. But it also damages the self. It damages the person who is watching this, right? It undermines their ability to relate to others appropriately. It makes it that much easier for them to strip down this person to fit exactly the mold they need to satisfy whatever desires or needs they themselves have. It impairs you. It tears down who you were made to be in the image of God, because you are a son and a daughter of God just as much as the people that we lust after are made in the image of God, our sons and daughters of God. Just like with anger, whenever we're angry at someone, we're angry at a son or a daughter of God, right? And it harms your relationship with God. Because just like any of you who have children, I speak from a wealth of experience, let me tell you. But if somebody is angry at your child, right, that hurts you as a person too. Even if it's another child you have, even if it's their brother or sister, sometimes even more so, it hurts you whenever somebody is angry at your child. In the same way, it also hurts God whenever we lust after God's children, whenever we try and tear down who they are in the image of God. We weren't created to do this to each other. And when we do, it diminishes who we are in the image of God. It's exactly like Jesus says with the amputation of body parts. It makes us less whole. We might as well pop out our eye. We might as well cut off our right hand if it offends, because this is what we're doing whenever we lust after one another. And one of the reasons this is so important is because sexuality is a gift from God, which is something that you don't always hear in the contemporary church. ever since Augustine, we've been kind of afraid to talk about sex as a positive thing, talk about sexuality as a positive thing, but it's a gift from God. The way the Jewish people at least understood it, it was an act of creation, even when there wasn't a child that came about from it, it's an act of creation. It's these two people coming together to create a new thing, a new person. Even if it's not a literal new person, it is this creative act. It's creating something more than was there before. And so adultery then is tantamount to murder. It's killing this new creature that you have created together. But sexuality is a gift from God. That's why lust is such a dangerous thing. It's because sexuality is such a good and powerful gift. It's not meant to be casually used. It's sexuality isn't a private possession that a person can exercise according to their desires. Lust is isolating, even if it's exercised between two people. But love creates something more, something better. Human sexuality is a good gift that's meant to mirror the faithful, the intimate covenant relationship between Christ and the church. It's a relationship that sees the other person not as an object, but as a person and a child of God. When Jesus was talking, we can see in Jesus' talking on the subject, Jesus is focusing on men talking to women, right? This is modern day America. We know that both men and women are culpable in this. But in Jesus' community in the ancient world, women were viewed as objects. They were viewed as property. They're viewed as legally as things. And Jesus is calling on the church to see women as more than what the legal community of Rome saw them as. He calls on the church to see women not as seductresses, but as sisters. And of course, he also calls us today, calls on women to see men as more than that, to see women, to see men as brothers and as sons of God. In Jesus' day, women were literal legal objects. It's true. Today, though, women are still perceived as objects. It's not in a literal or a legal sense. We've come a long way. But women are often viewed as objects. I mean, you only have to turn on TV again. You only have to look at a Hardee's commercial and you see how women are turned into sexual objects. It's a problem. I was going to walk through the entire history of the way that the church and culture, Western culture in particular, has seen women. We might get into that later on if we have time. But we tend to objectify women, right? Far more so than we do men. It's not to say that it's not a problem, that men are never objectified, but it is much more so with women. And there's a reason that women are largely the victims of the sex trade industry. It's a culture that we've created. This is something I didn't realize in myself until I was a junior in college. And I had this sort of awakening of realizing that I wouldn't see a woman as a person as much as I would see a man as a person. And I had to ask myself the question, like, why is this the case? Why would I think this way? Why would I feel this way? It's not something that was overt. It's something that was sort of implicit in the way that I viewed things. It's easy to go unexamined. And truthfully, our society, our culture kind of moves men towards lust. It's just like pornography. You're viewing through this screen a person. It's helping you to tear them down as a human being, to make them what you want them to be. And we do that with every aspect of media. We transform women into these objects, these sexual objects. And after enough movies and television and advertisement, it's really easy to see how men could get into the habit of tearing women down to be what they want them to be, seeing them as slightly less than what men are. I can't speak for all men, but I can speak for myself. I can say that this is something that I have had to work to change, but also that I feel God has empowered me to change in myself. It's not an easy thing. In the community of the kingdom of heaven, we practice love rather than lust. We practice self-giving, person-honoring love for each other. We recognize that lust is a cheap substitute for love. It's a veggie burger when you ordered a steak, right? Lust is a shortcut that doesn't deliver. It doesn't deliver the things that it's supposed to promise. It keeps taking and taking. It robs the one objectified, and it robs the person objectifying of their value and of their personhood. Lust is something that tears people down. It tears away who they were in the image of God. But love is something that calls us together, that builds us up into something more. And I know that I'm repeating myself. It's important. The community of the kingdom of heaven is called to practice love. And love, unlike lust, is not predatory. The way we sometimes view relationships, the way we've been taught to view relationships, sometimes they become a predator-prey sort of mentality, right? There's a song by Maroon 5 from 2014. This is not from 30, 40, 100 years ago. This is from 2014. There's a song by Maroon 5. The chorus goes, "Baby, I'm praying on you tonight. Hunt you down, eat you alive, just like animals, animals, like animals." Like, just coming out and saying what most songs are just sort of implying. But this is the way that we sometimes view relationships, right? This is the way that we sometimes view courtship and romance. And it's dangerous. This is lust. These are lust-filled relationships. This is tearing of each other down. It's robbing both of us of who we are in the image of God. The community of the kingdom of heaven is called to practice love, a love that sees each other as children of God, that sees women as daughters of God, men as sons of God, and together we are brothers and sisters in Christ. But this message is not about controlling your urges. Because sometimes whenever people read this, they hear "control your urges." It's the place we immediately go to. But the point is this. The world lives this way. Lust is the norm in a world broken by sin. People objectify people. We use each other for pleasure. Two people lusting together, it's normal. But it's isolating. We're called to be transformed. Transformed to live not according to the world, but to live another way. Look at that. Work the title right in there. To live according to this right side up reality in the kingdom of heaven. I mean, not committing adultery is possible. Tons of people do it. A lot of relationships, most marriages even, adultery isn't a factor. You can do that on your own. But not lusting is something that is impossible unless you're empowered by grace to live differently. Unless other grace-empowered people are walking along beside you, offering you their shoulder, offering you their hand, helping you to see each other as made in the image of God. Because this is what the church is. The church is a group of people seeing each other as made equally in the image of God. The church is a group of people who see each other and see children of God, who see people made in the image of God. And as you are seeing other people in this way, they are seeing you in this way. And it helps you to see yourself as more made in the image of God. It builds up while lust is tearing down. Here again is the call to live differently in this world, in an upside-down world. We're called to right side up living. We're empowered by the transforming grace of God. We no longer have to live as the world lives. We're called to live another way. And through God's grace, we can live another way. See that? That's three times. Three times I worked the title in there. You guys are welcome to be impressed. Let's check our time real quick. Okay. We go until 7, is that right? 7:30. Whoa, we have 20 minutes. That's perfect. Okay. So, sorry, but this is great, because I really did want to talk about the progression of the way that Western culture has perceived women, because there's this sort of mentality. Sometimes we can get rooted into these ways of thinking. Like we say, oh, men are visual creatures. Oh, men are like more base, they're more emotion-driven, and women are just, they are different. This has not always been the way that we viewed things. So around Jesus's time up until the time of the Victorian era, there's this concept called dualism, right? It says there's the spiritual and there's the material. The material is bad. The spiritual is good. The spiritual is also the cognitive. It's what's happening in your brain. And men, the thought was, are closer to the cognitive. Men are less emotionally driven. Men aren't as carnal. They are higher. They are closer to God in this way. They think more. Women feel more. Because women, you know, I mean, they have cycles that are tied to the moon, and they give birth. Look at all these material things that women do. Am I right? I'm not right. It was seen, okay, so women are so connected to the material, that must mean they are baser creatures. They're closer to animals than they are to God. Women are more carnal. Women are more prone to lust, and if you don't watch them, they will drag men down. In this way of thinking, so men are seen, men, whenever they practice chastity, are seen as getting closer to God. They are becoming more and more godlike. But whenever women practice chastity, well, they're just becoming more like men. To the point that Thomas Aquinas, brilliant church father, but Thomas Aquinas actually thought that when women got to heaven, that they would become men. I'm not Thomas Aquinas. I don't think this. I just want to throw that out there. So anyway, so up until the Victorian era, this was the way that we viewed women. Right? But then something changed, and this was sort of turned on its head. Suddenly, women were seen as more in the image of the Virgin Mary, right? They're closer to this. They are these pure things, still things, mind you, but they are put up on a pedestal. They are beacons to which we should all aspire. They are responsible, of course, for curbing the urges in men who are now baser creatures, but they are responsible for the behavior of men. And so this was the attitude of the Victorian era. Women are put up on this purity pedestal, but they still, you know, they're not quite as holy as men. But then now we have this sort of merging of these two cultures, right? It's really weird the way that we view women now, because we view women as these sort of these pure creatures. Women are, or men are baser at least. We say men are more visual. Men are more lust prone, right? But at the same time, women are seen as seductresses somehow. Women are still torn down in this way. And so Jesus here is calling us to live in this other way. He's calling us to see one another as made in the image of God, equally made in the image of God. Because when God created, right, there was the human person, and then that person was divided into men and women, equally made in the image of God. And we are called to see each other. Women are daughters of God, regardless of what they wear, regardless of how they act. They are daughters of God. And men are sons of God. Regardless of what they wear, regardless of how they act, men are sons of God. And this is how we are called to see each other. This is how we are called to build each other up. And again, it's not something that we can necessarily do on our own, but it's something that we are called to work out together, that we are called to, through grace-empowered living, to see each other as made equally in the image of God, to see each other as equally men and women who are